This is the slide talk, PowerPoint talk, Cosmos and Contact, Evidence of Design in the Universe by Robert C. Newman. The abstract reads like this. Playing off of Carl Sagan's dictum, the cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be, and his interest in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, as depicted in the science fiction film Contact, we note that the universe itself actually contains at least three striking messages indicating a superintellect has put it all together. First, the design of the universe itself. Second, the striking nature of our place in it. And third, the existence and nature of living things. Carl Sagan, you may be aware, was kind of the media guru of science and society, if you like, up to near his death in 1996. He became famous primarily, I think, with his PBS series Cosmos back in the 1970s, which was then turned into a book. Sagan's opening statement in his PBS series Cosmos is, "The cosmos is all it is, or ever was, or ever will be." Interesting statement. Is it a scientific statement? It's hard to see how it is. It might be a definition, although he does not handle it that way in his book and series. It appears to be a worldview statement of some sort, that Sagan believes that there's nothing but nature, if you like. Sagan doubts, indeed, that God exists, and this shows up several places in his book, Cosmos. Yet he believes that life exists elsewhere in the universe, in spite of life's enormous complexity. Sagan wrote the article Life in two editions of the Encyclopedia Britannica, and there pictures the enormous complexity of life in terms of a computer analogy, that the information content of the E. coli bacterium is 10 to the 12th power bits, equivalent to about 100 million pages in the Encyclopedia Britannica. However, Sagan, on extraterrestrial life, believes that in some places this life must include very advanced life forms. He believes that such advanced life is common enough to be worth searching for. Sagan is not the only one to think that there's extraterrestrial intelligence out there and it's worth searching for. Many others besides Sagan have such dreams. Perhaps they think we can contact such life, and perhaps these beings have solved the difficult and dangerous problems we face today. Nuclear proliferation, global warming, things of that sort. Well, the most likely way to contact an advanced civilization, short of their coming and visiting us, would be through its radio signals. And the radio telescope developed after World War II has been used some in looking for such signals. Besides Sagan's PBS series Cosmos, Sagan also wrote a science fiction novel, Contact, and that became, just in the months leading up to his death, a film with the same title, Contact. Here we see a picture from that film, and the hero of the film is the astrophysicist Ellie Arroway, who's shown here in the front of this picture, who devotes her professional career to searching for extraterrestrial intelligence, a move that many astrophysicists would have thought then and certainly would still think today and think in the movie that is a waste of her talent and time. However, despite many setbacks, a long-awaited message finally comes, a strong signal from the star system Vega. This signal is seen to be more than radio waves, noise, by the presence of, in the signal, of prime numbers, which indicate an intelligent source. Eventually, a more complex message is found in the signal, instructions to build a device to transport a human to the Vega system. After several twists in the plot, which involve the destruction by a deranged Christian fundamentalist or evangelical in destroying the transporter, Ellie winds up going to Vega on the backup transporter, which has been constructed secretly by a wealthy industrialist. We would normally show a 15-minute clip here in our presentation, a clip that runs from when she arrives at the Vegas system. We see her coming back to consciousness, floating down, if you like, and winds up inside what is turns out to be a virtual reality scene from a picture that she made in her childhood of Daytona Beach. And there she is met by someone who looks like her father, as he looked shortly before he died when she was still young. And turns out to be one of the Vegans using this method to contact her, to speak to her, etc., and telling her what their whole reasons for contacting other civilizations are. Ellie is sent back to Earth, and it transpires when she arrives that the transporter from Earth time does not appear to have been gone for any period of time, rather like the scenario we see in C.S. Lewis's Narnia Chronicles, in which the kids often return from Narnia without any elapsed time on Earth. People have trouble then believing that she really has seen what she has, and there's some very interesting scenes there in that part of the film regarding the whole question of what kind of evidence do you need to establish reality and believability, and what's the place of Occam's razor in all of this. We're not going to follow that here. We do want to pick up, however, on Carl Sagan's statements on how we would recognize an extraterrestrial message sent by an extraterrestrial intelligence, obviously. And he points out, first of all, that we would need a strong signal. In the science fiction novel and the film, this is a signal, radio signal, that's detectable by multiple radio telescopes. We need to be pretty sure that this is not just radio noise, that this is not just some chance sort of signal that has come from the radio output of various stars and galaxies and such out there. And in his story, a few dozen prime numbers in the signal are sufficient, though as the film goes on, several other things develop to make that clear as well. As the story goes in the book, the whole message to build the transport machine is about 50,000 pages of text. We'll keep that in mind as we come back to the end of our talk here. Now, the interesting thing is that the book ends with Ellie, although she has not been believed on this trip to Vega and back, discovering a message in the digits of the mathematical constant pi. Sagan tells us that this signal is found in base 11 arithmetic. That's the kind of numbers used by librarians in the ISBN system. And that this message is a square picture made up of zeros and ones when you divide up the relevant portion of the message at the right places. And the picture turns out to be a circle of ones in a field of zeros. Sagan comments then as a narrator, this is a simple message, but it is of high statistical significance. It tells us that the universe was made on purpose. And so we hear in this section of the PowerPoint, we show you what the signal might have looked like coming in, where I've highlighted the ones with red so that you can spot them easily in the midst of this sea of zeros surrounding it. And so you get something like this, a series of digits that show a red circle in a series of zeros. And the film doesn't end that way. Many more people have seen the film and probably are aware of that if you've seen the film then. There's no message from God in the film. Why not? Well, I don't know. I don't have any secret agents, and as far as I know, nothing has been said publicly about it. Did Hollywood veto this ending? That's certainly possible. Until very recently, Hollywood has tended to be rather hostile of theistic films, if you like. Did Sagan himself back away from what I call the precipice of theism in his last years? That's certainly possible as well. We really do not know. We do know that Sagan's novel, Contact, is far more open to theism than his very last book published, The Demon-Haunted World, is, in which he's very fearful of New Age movement and of any kind of Orthodox Christianity and such, because he's trying to keep supernatural out of the universe. In Sagan's novel, Contact, there are three characters who we would consider Orthodox Christians, and two of the three are treated fairly favorably. The third one is the fellow who bombs the Vega transporter, so he's obviously not treated too favorably. But the blind fellow who works at Ellie's lab is pictured as a probably an Eastern Orthodox Christian. And the fellow who becomes the second hero, if you like, is a evangelical of some sort in the book, although he looks rather New Age in the film. Well, this particular thing of the message in Pi raises an interesting question for us. Could God do something like this? Could God put a message in the digits of Pi? And of course, some people will say, well, of course, God can do anything. I think, however, it's somewhat doubtful that God could put a message there. The reason for this, I say, is that Pi is built into the structure of logic, and so is not something that's variable. And God cannot do what is contradictory. God cannot lie. God cannot say things that make no sense, because those things go against God's own nature. So I'm doubtful, at least, that God could put a message in the digits of Pi, though, of course, I might be wrong. Could God do something like this? Could God send us some other message? And my response there would be, why not? Why not? Well, where might God put such a message? Well, we might put it in something he has created. Do we have any candidates for such a medium and such a message? Yes, we do. Here we will consider in this PowerPoint talk three of them. Those of you who are Christians would recognize that a fourth candidate for such a medium would be the Bible, and the message would be its contents. But the three we look at here are the universe itself. Might God put such a message in the universe itself, understood rather broadly? Might he put such a message in the peculiar features, as we'll see, of our place in the universe? And might God put such a message in living things? Well, let's see. Let's look, first of all, at the question of a message in the universe. Well, in the last 20 years or so now, 25 years perhaps, scientists have become aware of a phenomenon relating to the basic forces and basic constants of our universe, which now has come to be called fine-tuning, or sometimes the anthropic principle. Some bibliography on this, although the renewal of interest in this is from the 80s, 1980s. Lawrence J. Henderson, back in 1915, wrote a book, The Fitness of the Environment, which, 1913, I believe, The Fitness of the Environment, which pointed to some very striking features about chemistry that were rather unique and yet had to be that way in order for life to exist. In the 80s, as I mentioned, the physicist Paul Davies, British physicist Paul Davies, published a work, The Accidental Universe, pulling together a number of these features of fine-tuning. And then shortly behind him, John Barrow and Frank Tipler produced the more massive work, The Anthropic Cosmological Principle. And although Barrow and Tipler seem to be determined to try and avoid the idea that there is a designer behind this, the evidence looks really very strong, even as they present it, looks very strong for a designer. The Christian astronomer and evangelist Hugh Ross, in his book The Creator and the Cosmos, has pulled together a good deal of this material we're going to think about in The Message in the Universe, as well as material in the second topic, which we'll look at, our particular position in the universe. And then, rather recently, Michael Denton, an Australian microbiologist, has written up a good deal of this material in a work called Nature's Destiny. So any of those books would be worth investigating, and all of those are, I believe, still available from Amazon, Henderson's work in a reprint, and the others in either still in print or available as used copies. Let's think about one important area of fine-tuning, and that's fine-tuning the basic forces we know about in the universe. We're not sure exactly how many basic forces there might be, but we know about four of them. There's some possibility of a fifth in recent years, but the four we know about well are the strong force, a force that holds the nucleus of an atom together. It's a very short-range force. It dies out very quickly when you get beyond size scales the size of a nucleus, but it's quite strong, which is how it got that name. And we will give it a strength 1 for comparison with the other forces we're going to be looking at here. Next in strength is the electromagnetic force, the force that holds the electrons around the nucleus, the force that holds compounds together, molecules together, and the force which has both attractive and repulsive features to it, and therefore makes solids possible. Objects that you can pull on and they resist, and push on and they resist, etc. It's a long-range force. It falls off with distance, as all these forces do, but falls off with the inverse square of the distance, and has strength only about 1/100 the strength of a strong force. A third force, probably least well-known of the four, is the weak force. That's the force that we might say holds the nucleus together. It does some other things. It's a very short-range force, and it's got a strength about 1/100,000th of the strong force, or then about 1/1,000th of the electromagnetic force. And fourthly, there's gravity. Gravity is like electromagnetism, a long-range force falling off with the inverse square of the distance, but it's got very, very low strength. Its strength is compared to the strong force 1/10^39. So it's smaller by a factor of 10^39 than the strong force is. That's 1 with 39 zeros after it. Oh, it's very much weaker. Well, these forces are very divergent in strength. 1/100, 1/100,000th, and 1/10^39. As divergent in strength as these forces are, very slight changes in any of them would be disastrous for having a universe that would permit life to exist. The strong forces I mentioned hold the nucleus together. Here's a little diagram, a sort of artist's conception of what a nucleus might look like. We're pretty sure that it doesn't look like it's red and orange billiard balls with N's and P's on them, but whatever. If the strong force were only half as strong as it is, 50% weaker, there would be no stable elements but hydrogen. That is, the repulsive forces of putting together two protons would... not be strong enough, would be stronger than the attractive force to hold them together. And so we'd have nothing but hydrogen in our universe, which would certainly make it impossible to have any life based on chemistry. If the force were only 5% weaker, there'd be no deuterium. That's a heavy form of hydrogen. It's a hydrogen that the nucleus, instead of just a proton, is a proton plus a neutron. And although this is not something we use every day, this turns out to be something that stars use every day to convert from hydrogen to helium, that is to burn, and to produce their energy. And so without deuterium, stars won't burn. So if the strong force were 5% weaker, there'd be no stars. If the force were 5% stronger, then the diproton would be stable. That's a nucleus with two protons and no neutrons, a very, very light form of helium. The forms of helium that we actually have are two protons with another neutron, a light helium, helium-3, and the normal kind of helium, helium-4, has got two protons and two neutrons in the nucleus. Those are stable, but the diproton is not stable at the strength of the strong force, but if a strong force were 5% stronger, the diproton would be stable, and stars would burn explosively, and that would be disastrous for having life as well. So the strong force is tuned to plus or minus 5% on the basis of just these considerations, how stars burn. It might turn out that if we looked more carefully, we could find some other features of nuclear interactions that would require that the strong force be tuned tighter than that. But at least we can say that the strong force is tuned to at least plus or minus 5%. The weak force is the force that holds a neutron together. Here's Artist's conception of a neutron made up of three quarks. Those are the little orange balls there, two downs and an up quark. And you see, if you didn't know about it already, that although many of us were trained in high school and such, that the smallest charge that exists was the charge on the electron and proton, and yet if quarks really exist, and the evidence is pretty strong they do, then we have charges of 2/3 and 1/3 of that amount, and we see them here in the neutron. The two down quarks have -1/3 the charge on electron, and the up quark has 2/3 the charge, and they cancel each other out. Well, the weak force holds a neutron together, and if we take a neutron out of a nucleus, the neutron becomes unstable and has a half-life of only 13 minutes, which would make it a rather radioactive sort of thing. The neutron in the half-life of 13 minutes decays into a proton, an electron, and an antineutrino. Well, if the weak force were just a few percent weaker than it is, then in the time of the early history of the Big Bang, very few neutrons would have formed, or stayed formed, let's say, and the upshot would have been there'd be very little helium in the universe, and as a result, few heavy elements. And even those elements that there would be would stay trapped in stars for other reasons related to the strength of the weak force. If the weak force were a few percent stronger than it is, then there'd be lots of neutrons, and the result would be too much helium in the universe, too many heavy elements, but these two would stay trapped in stars. Well, we need at least a few heavy elements in order to have things like planets and people, and we need these to be outside stars, okay? So if the weak force were either a few percent stronger or a few percent weaker, then we do not have life, anything like we know it anyway, anything outside stars, based on chemistry anyway. We see then that the weak force is tuned to a few percent. We move to electromagnetism. That's the force I mentioned that holds the atom together, holds the molecules together, that holds the electrons around the nucleus of an atom, holds the molecules together. It's a both attractive and repulsive force. If you remember from high school physics or chemistry or whatever, that two electrons, two negative charges, repel each other. Two positive charges, like two protons, repel each other, but a positive and negative attract. And so the electromagnetic force is both a repulsive and attractive force to the existence of these positive and negative charges. Now, in order for the electromagnetic force not to completely swamp gravity, which turns out to be quite important, the plus and minus charges must be almost exactly equal in number to better than 1 part in 10 to the 40th power, not only over the universe as a whole, but also locally. And that is a pretty tight constraint, huh? Yet the evidence we have regarding the early history of the universe suggests that protons and electrons froze out at different times in the early universe. We know that protons and electrons are drastically different in mass. The protons are nearly 2,000 times heavier than the electrons, 1,800 and something, as I recall. And as the universe is cooling down from a very hot, very dense state, you have a time period in which the temperature of the universe is above, the energy of the temperature is above that necessary to produce proton-antiproton pairs. That is, the energy of the temperature of the universe, if you like, is greater than 2 times the mass of the proton times c squared. And as long as it stays above that, you get protons and antiprotons flying around. But as the temperature drops below that, the protons and antiprotons then colliding annihilate one another, and the temperature is no longer big enough to make new ones, and so gradually we begin to lose these. And the upshot is, rather interestingly, that instead of exactly canceling out so that we have no protons or antiprotons, we run out of antiprotons while there's still some protons left. Not many, perhaps only 1,000th as many as there were before, but still some left. The temperature of the universe cools now by nearly 2,000, and until it gets down to that point, we have lots of electrons and anti-electrons, what we call positrons, speeding around, smashing into one another. But when the temperature, the energy of the temperature drops below 2 times the mass of the electron times the speed of light squared, E equals mc squared, then the electrons and proton pair production cannot take place with collisions of things. And so as the electrons and protons now begin to collide, they annihilate, and there's not enough energy to make new ones. And when the dust settles, there's some electrons left over, and all the positrons are gone. And lo and behold, when all of these are gone, the number of electrons and protons are very nearly the same, same to within 1 part in 10 to the 40th power. If it weren't for this equality, the electromagnetic force would dominate gravity, which are both inverse square forces, and there'd be no galaxies, no stars, no planets. So the electromagnetic force is tuned to 1 part in 10 to the 40th power. Big number. gravity. Gravity is the force that holds us on the surface of our planet and holds the atmosphere down here for us to breathe, and holds our Earth in orbit around the Sun and our Sun in orbit around the galaxy, etc. It's the dominant force on the astronomical size scale. It turns out that our universe is expanding, and that it was discovered when the equations were worked out for how a universe would expand, given that general relativity is correct. It turned out that we need a very close balance of gravity pulling everything together, and cosmic expansion pushing everything apart to have a stable universe. And if gravity had been weaker early on by 1 part in 10 to the 60th, the universe would have expanded too quickly and no galaxies or stars would have been formed. If gravity had been stronger at that time by 1 part in 10 to the 60th, then the universe would collapse without forming galaxies or stars. So gravity is fine-tuned to 1 part in 10 to the 60th. We try to pull all the stuff together to summarize our fine-tuning, if you like. We find that combining these four cases gives fine-tuning of better than 1 part in 10 to the 100th power. That's a big number. How big is 10 to the 100th power? Well, it's 1 with 100 zeros after it. But it's although it's kind of easy to draw that kind of number on the board, although it'll take up some space, it's rather hard to visualize it. The estimates today are that there are perhaps some 10 to the 80th elementary particles in our universe, electrons, protons, neutrons, etc. And that's actually out to the Hubble radius. We don't know for sure how big the universe is exactly. And so in order to get 10 to the 100th particles, we'd need 10 to the 20 universes. Well, we can kind of name that number without too much trouble. 10 to the 3rd is 1,000, 10 to the 6th is 1,000,000, 10 to the 9th is 1,000,000,000, and so 10 to the 18th is 1,000,000,000,000, and this is 100,000,000,000,000 universes to get 10 to the 100th elementary particles. 1 part in 10 to the 100th would be like the chances of picking out one specially marked elementary particle out of all of these 10 to the 20 universes. Imagine that these particles are black, we'll say, and one of them is painted red and mixed among the other universes, and you blindfolded need to pick the right universe, and then blindfolded pick the right part of that universe, and blindfolded pick the right particle out of that universe. That's one chance in 10 to the 100th. Very, very small. Well, summary on fine-tuning. We have fine-tuning the universe about 1 part in 10 to the 100th for the cases we've examined. Hugh Ross, in his book, The Creator and the Cosmos, lists 22 more items besides these four. None are quite as good as the 10 to the 40 and the 10 to the 60, but you're still going to get a very, very small chance or a very, very big number of the alternative possibilities that you only have one of, etc. Do we have any evidence for even 10 to the 100th universes to make this fine-tuning likely merely by chance? For if you've got no designer in the universe, there's no reason antecedently to think that a universe existing randomly, formed randomly, would have anything like this kind of fine-tuning. To solve that problem from an atheistic perspective, you have to imagine you've got enough universes out there to make this likely merely by chance. And therefore, you would need 10 to the 100th universes just for these four cases we examined. Well, we don't have any evidence for two universes for sure. There might be. It might be more than that. But we don't have any evidence for it. So atheism at this point depends upon making guesses for which we have no evidence. In contrast, the universe really does look designed. And to get around this, one has to do strange things. In fact, the universe seems to be sending us a message to this effect. That's what we suggest as the message from the universe as a whole, that the universe is telling us it is designed. Sir Fred Hoyle, a major astrophysicist who passed away a few years ago, was also a prominent atheist when I was in grad school back in the 60s. And he came to become a theist as a result of investigating fine-tuning and such. And one of his comments after this happened was that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics, as well as with chemistry and biology. A rather striking statement. I've heard in some Christian circles occasionally, well, none of the arguments you have prove to us that we've got an infinite God. And that, of course, is correct. There's no way for a finite being to tell empirically whether there's an infinite God or not, if you like. But Hoyle's remark of a superintellect who can monkey with the physics and chemistry and biology of the universe indicates that we're looking at some kind of a mind and some kind of a power that certainly puts any of the old pagan gods, Thor, Zeus, Jupiter, etc., totally in the shade. So at least we'd have to say our message seems to point in that kind of direction. We move to our second topic, and that is our place in the universe. Besides the fine-tuning of these basic forces, our particular location in the universe is quite special, a matter of many features being just right. We're not talking about trivial features. We're talking about features that are necessary for living beings to exist on our planet Earth. In his 1995 edition of Creator and the Cosmos, Ross lists over 33 of these drawn from the scientific literature. He has since pulled together something that pulls that up into the 60s, I believe, now. We're going to just look at a few of these 33, however, in this presentation. We live on, first of all, the right planet in regard to its temperature. The temperature, of course, on Earth varies from place to place, season to season, but there are very few places on the surface of the Earth above the boiling point. We can think of geysers and lava pools and things of that sort. There are a number more that are below freezing. I can think of the Arctic and Antarctic, at least during the winter seasons at each place. But contrast all of this with the planet Venus, the nearest planet to our size and the nearest planet perhaps to our distance from our sun. It's in a little closer, but its temperature is about 900 degrees Fahrenheit on its surface, or if you're into a metric system, about 500 degrees Celsius. A fierce temperature, huh? On contrast, Mars, rather smaller planet than ours, but the nearest one further out beyond ours, the temperature barely gets above freezing in midwinter at the equator, much less hospitable to living things. We can kind of contrast the situation with regard to temperature, or kind of summarize the situation with regard to temperature by saying that the Earth is warm enough for water to be liquid, rather important for any kind of fast-moving reactions in living things, and cool enough not to destroy the biomolecules. Biomolecules tend to come apart at high temperatures, and at least for any kind of life we know about, the chemistry requires pretty complicated molecules which have to stay together. We live in the right planet regarding water as well. Much water is needed to support life. There are, of course, a few organisms on Earth that have techniques to conserve it and can live in pretty arid regions. Water on Venus and Mars is infinitesimal by comparison. There is some thought that perhaps we will find some significant amount of water at the poles and perhaps below the surface on Mars, and that may indeed turn out to be so, but water on Venus and Mars is still infinitesimal by comparison. Earth's water would correspond, if we smoothed Earth out, to about 2 miles deep everywhere. And Earth water is also concentrated at the surface. So another one of those features, we've got the right planet in regard to water. We've got the right planet in regard to atmosphere. A balance of oxygen and what we might call inert gases. Nitrogen is not totally inert, you understand, but doesn't do a whole lot in regard to animals breathing and that sort of thing. And then other things like argon and such. But if we had a few percent less oxygen than we do, we've got around 21%, then it turns out that animals don't have enough to breathe. And if we've got a few percent more oxygen than the 21% we do, it turns out that plants will burn up. For every percent you raise the oxygen in our atmosphere, the likelihood of a forest fire jumps by nearly 80%. By contrast, Mars and Venus have virtually no free oxygen. We've got the right planet in regard to mass. Hard to get a visual demonstration of mass, so this visual demonstration here on the right is of size. The yellow on the left of the picture is the edge of the sun, and shows you how big that is compared to the other planets and moons in our solar system and asteroids. And then the orange shows you the edge of Jupiter, and the I guess that's kind of a bluish purple maybe shows you the edge of Saturn, and the brown the edge of Uranus, and the pink the edge of Neptune, and then the blue dot Earth, and the brown dot Venus, etc. Well, that gives you a little idea of the relative sizes, and masses are in that ballpark. If Earth were only a quarter massive as it is, which would be true of all of the planets smaller than Earth but Venus, our atmospheric pressure would be too low for life. If Earth were twice as massive as it is, which would be true of all the planets bigger than Earth, the atmospheric pressure would be too high, producing a greenhouse effect and killing all life. We get the right mass in our planet, huh? Strangely enough, we have the right moon, both in regard to its size and distance. Our moon is unique in our solar system. It's by far the largest moon compared with its planet. There are only three or four moons bigger than our moon, and they're all around much, much bigger planets than ours. It turns out our moon is rather important in stabilizing the Earth's axial tilt, so allowing seasons and such. If our moon were smaller or further away, Earth's climate would be unstable. There'd be a tendency for the axis to flop over long periods of time, over thousands of years, and that would be pretty disastrous. And then the perhaps smaller problem would be that the tides would be too small for life that lives in the intertidal zone, where the tides bring in nourishment to these plants and animals and carry away waste products. If our moon were larger or closer, the tidal effects on the Earth's rotation on its ocean and its atmosphere would be too large. We have examples that we found where a planet is facing a star, or a moon is facing a planet, etc., due to tidal locking. And the upshot when a planet is facing its star, its sun, in that case, is the temperature gets enormously hot on the sun side and enormously cold on the away from the sun side. So that would be pretty disastrous there. The ocean and atmosphere tides would be less drastic than that, but can produce serious meteorological effects if you have a much larger tide. Huh? Interestingly, there's a connection between the right moon and the Earth's crust. If the Earth's crust were thicker, it would eat up the atmospheric oxygen. If the Earth's crust were thinner, there'd be too much volcanic activity, too much plate movement, etc. on Earth. So the Earth's crust is, if you like, just right. But the moon apparently formed from the Earth's crust early in Earth's history when we were struck by a Mars-sized planet. Very fluky event, which basically means that this collision took off a lot of the Earth's crust to get it down in the right range and produce a moon big enough to stabilize the Earth's axial tilt. A very fluky event indeed, and one which we would not expect to happen very often. Bright sun. Our sun has the right character. Here we have a picture of what we call the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, with the kind of backward S, or whatever you call it, in the middle of the picture is the stars that are currently burning their hydrogen to helium, and our star is the one shown by the circle around it. And then up at the top we have stars that are giants of one sort, supergiants and giants, and these are ones that have finished using their hydrogen at the middle of the star, and as a result get to more hydrogen to burn to helium. The outer part of the star's atmosphere is expanded and they become giant stars. Would be rather disastrous to be around a star of that sort, because the surface of the star itself would come out to where our Earth is. And then the dwarf stars down in the lower left side of this picture are stars that have used up all of the accessible hydrogen fuel and have collapsed to form these little white dwarfs, which gradually then cool off and will eventually become red dwarfs and black dwarfs and such. The mass of our sun is in the right range. A more massive star, such as those to the left on the main sequence, that S thing in the middle of Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, the ones to the upper left on that, don't last very long. They run through their fuel rapidly. Luminosity changes too quickly for stable life on the planet. If we go to the right, the lighter stars, they're smaller, and they burn their fuel much more cautiously, we might say, much more frugally. But the upshot is they're dimmer stars, and so a planet to be in the life zone, to be in a range where water is liquid, would have to be a lot closer into those stars. And the upshot is that the life zone is pretty narrow. It would be very hard for a star to stay in that zone. Have to be very, very circular orbit, and the tides are too large. You get in close to the star, you have big tides, and those tend to lock the planet so it's facing the star, its sun. And again, you get this huge temperature on the sun side and this very cold temperature on the away from the sun side. The temperature of our sun is in the right range. If it were redder, there would be insufficient photosynthesis for plants to make sugars out of sunlight. And if it were bluer, same problem. Huh? Rather interesting. That runs in a rather narrow range. And on top of that, the sun's radiation is right where our atmosphere is transparent. Something that doesn't appear that the atmosphere is designed for that in a fluky sense. Or that the radiation, you know, something doesn't seem to be something that the sun or the atmosphere can adjust to make that work out right. Our sun is in the right location as well. It's at the right distance from the center of its galaxy. We are at a range where if you're in much closer, you're going to have too many stars around, and their gravity will disrupt the orbit of our planet, and the radiation from these stars will disrupt our atmosphere and disrupt the life on the surface of the planet. If we're further away from the center of our galaxy, there will be too few heavy elements in the area and therefore less likelihood to form planets and such. We're also right for the occurrence of these exploding stars we call supernovae. If there were more of those or they were closer to us, they would exterminate life on the surface of Earth. But if there were less of them or they were further away, we would have too few heavy elements in our area. And again, we'd have the same problems with being too far from the center of the galaxy. It's also of some interest that we are just in the what we might call the equatorial plane of our galaxy, and we're just off one of these spiral arms. And both of those seem to be significant as well for having life on our planet. We also have a right number of stars in our planetary system, namely one. It looks like, with only a few exceptions, that star systems in which there are several stars rotating around one another are much less likely to produce planets in any kind of stable orbit around them. And obviously, if you've got less than one star, you might have the planet all right, but you certainly won't have any temperatures that will support life. We also live in the right kind of galaxy. There are basically three kind of galaxies. There are spiral galaxies, there are elliptical galaxies, and there are irregular galaxies. Our galaxy is a spiral. That's actually moderately rare. Perhaps 10 or 20% of the galaxies are spiral. And spirals are unusual in that they produce stars over much of its history, so that you can still have stars being produced at a time when you now have got some heavier elements. We're talking elements heavier than hydrogen, helium, lithium. In order to be able to have life, you've got carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, and those sorts of things. Ellipticals, which are the most common galaxies, are ones where star formation ends early on before there are really many heavy elements around, and so not likely to form planets and such. Irregular galaxies, which are the rarest kind, just a percent or so, are galaxies that are kind of funny shaped due to radiation events inside their center that would have destroyed life. So we got the right kind of galaxy as well. So if we try to pull these together and discuss our place in the universe, we have the right planet in regard to temperature, water, atmosphere, mass, etc. We've got the right moon in regard to its size and distance and the what's produced in regard to the Earth's crust. We've got the right sun in regard to its character and location. And we've got the right galaxy. We've looked at only a few cases, a few items, if you like. Ross calculates the probability of accidentally getting his 33 items in his early edition of Creator in the Cosmos, all in the right range as 1 chance in 10 to the 53rd power. That's one with 53 zeros after it. And what does this mean for the chances of finding an Earth-like planet in our universe? Well, of course, will depend on how many planets there are in the universe. If there are way more than 10 to the 53, then we're likely to have some others. If they're way less than 10 to 53, we're not. Well, there's surely not more than 10 planets per star that are at least around stars where they're getting enough radiation to operate. And if that's so, then in the Hubble volume, that distance out to the distance that light could travel since the Big Bang, that in a sphere of that radius, there are only about 10 to the 24 planets. And so only 1 chance in 10 to the 29 of even getting one such planet in our universe. Now, does that mean that there are only 1 chance in 10 to the 29 of any planets that are suitable for life out there? No, not necessarily, but it does mean that if we're depending upon chance, that's our best calculation at the moment. If we've got a designer, he can put as many out there as he wants, and we'll have to find out by observation how many that designer has done. That's where we are. It sounds like our place in the universe appears to be telling us something, and what it appears to be telling us is that the universe, our place in the universe, appears to be designed. We turn lastly to living things. Living things are by far the most complicated objects we have found yet in our universe. Though planets and stars may seem to be complicated things, they do not have the complicated functionality that living things have got. Carl Sagan, in his article Life and the additions, two or three editions back to the Encyclopedia Britannica, says that the E. coli bacterium, its information content is 10 to the 12th power bits, equivalent to 100 million pages of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Well, humans, of course, have trillions of cells, each more complicated than those of the E. coli bacteria. So, what's the probability of forming living things? Well, Fred Hoyle, the fellow who was a major atheist when I was in grad school, in his investigation of the chance formation of life, he came to the conclusion that it doesn't look like something happened by chance. In a memorable soundbite of his, he said the chance that higher life forms might have emerged accidentally is comparable with the chance of a tornado sweeping through a junkyard might assemble a Boeing 747 from the materials therein. In other words, not very likely. Well, that brings us back naturally to our discussion of Sagan and seeking a message from an extraterrestrial intelligence. How would we recognize that? He said, well, we need a strong signal. And in his novel and the film made from it, a signal that was detectable by several radio telescopes. That we have to be sure that this is not just chance, that this is not just noise, and a few dozen prime numbers was sufficient in his scenario. And then the whole message to build the transport machine turned out to be about 50,000 pages. By contrast, we ask, how would we recognize whether life is sending us a message or not? Well, we've got a strong signal. We've got some kind of signal in the DNA of all living things. It's the information by which the DNA guides the replication of these bacteria or one-celled animals or even multi-celled beings like we are. Decisive against chance. When you actually do the numbers, the information content of even the simple DNA is beyond what one researcher calls the probabilistic resources of the universe. We don't have a big enough universe. We don't have enough time to generate that kind of information content that is functional in some way. And then, contrasting with Sagan's story, the whole message to build an E. coli bacterium is about 100 million pages against his 50,000 pages for the Vega transporter. All of this suggests that if one believes that there is no designer out there, there is a need to adjust one's worldview. If Sagan really was open to the universe, he wanted to find out what it was really like, if he was really willing to consider the supernatural, as he claims to in his final book, The Demon-Haunted World, why didn't he respond to this sort of evidence? Well, I don't know. But he didn't, as far as I know. Why did he draw back from the precipice of theism? Well, I can't answer that. We may find out one day. I think we will. But the question we all need to consider is, do I need to adjust my worldview? Do you need to adjust your worldview? Well, that's the end of our talk. And the question comes home, what about you? What are you going to do with this kind of evidence?